Okay, so welcome everyone. This is the last night of the Guru Puja class. And Geshe-la will not be here tonight, so Lama La very kindly is going to be leading us in a review of the six perfections. So also just a reminder, Geshe-la has been teaching on the six perfections pretty much since the beginning of the year, and there will be a weekend retreat at the end of this month at Nolan's Farm when Geshe-la will be leading us in meditations on the six perfections. So there you can register for that online. If you click on the little homepage thing, that'll get you to where you can register. And now I'm going to turn it over to Venerable Lama.
Okay, so if you please turn to page 76 in the Essential Buddhist Prayers book. Page 76. Let's read the Heart Sutra. And I don't have the little stanza that goes before that that Rahula wrote, but to practice what Geshe-la says, for the sake of all sentient beings, we shall quickly actualize the Guru Deity's primordial state of Buddhahood, and in this very lifetime, we shall free all mother sentient beings from suffering and place them in the great bliss of Buddhahood. Therefore, we shall recite the Heart Affection of Wisdom Sutra, the extensive dispelling of hindrances according to the Heart Sutra, and we'll review the six perfections that are in the according to the Guru Puja. Okay, so the Heart of Perfection Wisdom. I prostrate to the Arya Triple Gem. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagawan was dwelling on Massa Vulture's Mountain in Rajagriha together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagawan was absorbed in the concentration and the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharabhatiputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciences are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore in an emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on, up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly, completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequal, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared, Teata om gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhi soha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, and those surrounding in their entirety, along with the worlds of gods, humans, asuras, and gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. This completes the Arya Bhagavati Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. Now the extensive dispelling of hindrances on page 81. I and all surrounding sentient beings go for refuge to the Buddha, go for refuge to the Dharma, go for refuge to the Sangha. We prostrate to the Great Mother Prajnaparamita, wisdom gone beyond, surrounded by all the children and by the assemblies of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the 10 directions. By depending on my prostrations to all of you, may these words of truth be actualized. In the past, the Deva King Indra dispelled the Maras, evil beings, by reflecting on the profound meaning of the wisdom gone beyond and reciting the profound words in Devi recitation. In that same way, I also reflect on the profound meaning of the Great Mother Prajnaparamita and recite the profound words in daily recitation. May all diseases, spirit possessions, bad conditions, all the negative directions, that which happens due to past karma and immediate conditions, may all this be dispelled, may it become non-existent, may be pacified. Thank you. Okay, so now let's turn to page 156 in the retreat prayer book. And so this is sort of what I thought I had in mind. I just heard about this noon? This day. Okay, so what I thought we could do is that we could read all together, read the stanza on each perfection. And so when we finish, for example, the perfect reading, LC 101, Perfection of Generosity, then I'll read out loud some of the main points that I thought Geshe-la taught to us, the things that are, in my view, I thought were the main points. And then we'll open it to discussion. And then when we're finished with generosity, we'll go down to ethics and we'll just keep going like that. How's that? Does that sound good to you? Okay. So let's read. Read the heading. Practicing the perfections after generating bodhicitta, the general practices of the bodhisattva, the perfection of generosity. I seek your blessings to complete the perfection of generosity through the guideline teaching of increasing the mind that gives without attachment, namely transforming my body, wealth, and collection of virtues of the three times into the object desired by each and every sentient being. Okay. So first, as an overall review of what he said, the practice of the six perfections is a bodhisattva practice, which will free ourselves from all problems forever. According to Shantideva and Maitreya Buddha, there are hundreds of thousands of bodhisattva deeds. But these deeds are summarized in the six perfections according to Maitreya Buddha. If here you are sincerely seeking enlightenment, then without the practice of six perfections, enlightenment is not going to be possible. So you practice each perfection combined with the other five perfections. For example, the generosity of generosity, generosity of ethics, patience, joyful effort, concentration, wisdom. You practice them simultaneously, not individually. So when giving, you can practice all the six perfections combined with generosity. You practice all the six perfections. So you practice all the six perfections combined with ethics, then you practice all the six perfections combined with patience, and so on. So, and to practice each perfection, you know, Geshe-la kept repeating each time the visualization. So since we're, you know, this is in connection with the Guru Puja, so we start, for each practice, each perfection, we start with the visualization of the main figure in the merit field, which is our Lama, inseparable from whatever deities that you might be doing, you know, like Yamantaka, whatever. But in our case, you know, it's just our Lama. And if you're not doing the Guru Puja, you can visualize Shakyamuni Buddha or Green Tara, which would be a lot simpler than the merit field. And you make a really strong request deep down from your heart. Please bless me to be able to do this practice of whatever perfections we're doing. Then we set our intention. I myself quickly achieve enlightenment, full enlightenment, in order to benefit all mother sentient beings. Therefore, I'm going to practice the perfection of, in this case, generosity. Then at the end of the practice, you visualize a five-colored nectar that flows into your body and the body of all living beings, and all the obstacles to practicing this perfection are completely removed, and you have generated that perfection in our heart and mind. But if you visualize both light and nectar, then you visualize the nectar flowing through a hollow light, like a hollow tube, sort of, and then generate the merit of your practice to the cause of which our attention, which is to quickly achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that would be our dedication. So that was what he sort of made like an introduction to the perfection. Now, the perfection of generosity, he said, the practice of generosity is not just about eliminating stinginess. Rather, it is developing or focusing on the mind's willingness to give without attachment. Give what? Your body, possessions, and merit. So you imagine, so this is like a mental practice. It's more than just, you know, giving gifts, material gifts. So you imagine transforming your body into whatever others need. So if beings need medicine, you transformed into numberless types of medicines. So you're doing it, you're imagining just benefiting one person, you're benefiting, you know, numerous beings, even those in the different realms, with just countless, numberless types of things to benefit them. So if they need medicine, numerous types of medicines. They need clothes, transformed into numerous items of clothing. They need roads, then you transform into roads, streets, highways, superhighways, all that. And you do this not just one time, but you do it over and over again. Then you imagined you solved all their problems. The problem is all the beings in the six realms, all their needs have been taken care of, and they all enjoy comfort, care, resources, and love. Okay, so that's what I sort of thought was the main points that Geshe-la mentioned. Okay, so would anyone, now as I mentioned before, Geshe-la is listening, and I know that maybe some other people will be listening too because we're streaming, so would you please use the mic? So if you want to make a comment or question, anybody? Comment, question? Okay, I think there's a mic. Lise, you send pass it to Tristan.
With the visualizations, is it best when visualizing transforming into either objects or phenomena that benefit all sentient beings to, visualize in, like, super fast, like, you know, hundreds of different frames of, like, things, or is it better to do, you know, one at a time? Because if I can't truly, see each of those things, how do I know it's not just a, or I guess really in terms of qualitative practice, is it better to go for, you know, as many kinds of mental, like a flooding of, you know, different things that you could transform into and to help people? Or is it better to kind of like a steady stream and see each leaf and each log and tadpole flowing down, and you really see it and you can see the person, and then you read their bio and you say, oh, they just had a baby, oh. Or, you know, more and not as specific, or less and very specific and detailed and personal?
Anybody want to make a comment about that? So you're saying which is better?
More effective.
More effective.
I have no knowledge. But I think that you need to look at your own mind about what is most effective for you in helping you to generate that feeling of generosity. In some ways, I think specificity, from what I've heard from the teachers, the more specific you are in what your visualization, the more power it's going to have in your heart. But, you know, also vastness is also beneficial. So I think as much as you could combine both of those options, maybe?
Maybe like one day, slow and steady, just like get really into the visualization, meet the person who just launched the pill that I transformed into, and, you know, and then the next day, it's like highway 65 traffic in some really fast place.
Well, yeah, what I was thinking was, you know, for example, you know, someone just had a baby, and maybe you could, you know, rejoice in that. And let's say she had, you know, problems. You know, just like problems, and then you could really visualize wishing that person to, you know, specifically that one person that you are familiar with in that particular situation, and really, you know, visualize her having perfect health, the baby being fine, all the procedures going well, healing everything. And then at that point, I was wondering if you could multiply that and then say, and may all women who have just had babies also be free of, problems from, you know, procedures, they heal well. What do you think of that?
Yeah,
is that okay?
Yeah, I think that's great. I have some notes that are a little, it's from Geshe-la, from the class. It's from the Songs of Experience. Generosity is like a wish-fulfilling jewel. He said we fill statues with mantras and things that is like a wish-fulfilling jewel. So people make huge effort to prostrate all the way to see the statue. So miserliness like that, practice generosity like a weapon to cut the knot. It's sort of, I write in his dialect, the power of the heart of this meditation will lead you out of depression or feeling down. Your imagination will free you from feeling daunted. So by those words, your imagination will free you, it sounds like whatever works for you, you know. And this is how you take the essence of the precious human rebirth. Think of something beautiful, dream something beautiful, and the result of this meditation gets carried through others. Like the brave child of the Buddha refers to the Bodhisattva. And imagine the blessings flowing from the merit field. And he said, not just blah, blah, blah. strong request has been made from your heart. So, you know, the nectars and everything. So it sounds like a little bit of whatever works, you know, is making you happy and making you feel. I mean, there's going to be days when you feel just like so generous and so full, and other days where you're just quiet. So I think it's like Donna said, and like what everybody said.
I have a question for anyone. What is the significance of quickly, saying it twice? Does anyone have...
I know what it is in the Guru Yoga, not in Guru Puja.
Maybe that'll help, though.
Okay. Well, in Lagandha and Lagyema, you know, there's quickly, and there's two interpretations. The first one is highest yoga tantra. So the first quickly in that interpretation refers to establishing, having the potency to establish enlightenment, what, three countless eons in the Sutrayana method. Mm-hmm. And then in the highest yoga tantra method, it would be 3 years, 3 months. And then in the profound, for the Ganden Lagema lineage, it would be the first quickly refers to having the potency to establish enlightenment in one single lifetime through highest yoga tantra, and then to the Ganden oral lineage in either 12 years or 3 years and 3 months. So that's what quickly means in Ganden Lagema. I don't know what it means in Guru Yoga, Guru Puja.
What is Ganden Lagema?
That's the Lama Tsongkhapa Guru Yoga, hundreds of deities of Land of Joy, Tushita.
Okay. So, super quickly.
Quickly.
I get the general idea.
Yeah, I don't remember even an element of what you remember. But I do remember that it referred literally to frames of time.
Jill says it refers to frames of time. Thank you.
So I have a question for the group. Since we're talking about the perfection of generosity, I guess how many, I mean, you can answer it if you want or you can think about it, but throughout the day, how many opportunities do we have to show our generosity in seemingly small ways or big ways? Or, in other words, I've only recently gotten pretty good at recognizing it, like analyzing the opportunity as it's presenting itself, and then I say, oh, this is a great opportunity to do this or do that, and then show or practice generosity. So I guess the question is, how many times in one Earth day, so that's 24 hours, does one have opportunities to practice generosity? How many moments in one 24-hour day does one have to practice generosity?
All of them, as Jill just said, yeah. Because you can practice generosity without physically offering material possessions. You can practice generosity, you walk into a grocery store and you think, may all beings have all the food that they need, you can see beautiful flowers blooming in the springtime and think, wow, may everybody enjoy this beauty and this, may all beings have, perfect temperate sunny weather. You can practice generosity of giving the Dharma by offering any kind of a teaching, whether it's something like a class or even just helping somebody overcome anger in a moment of anger. It doesn't have to be explicitly, here's the Dharma, but there's many ways you can be generous. I think Jill's right. You can be generous any moment in the day.
Thank you.
I wanted to just mention one practice that I've used, which is just called a threshold practice. And the idea is just whenever you walk across any change of surface, it can be an actual threshold or just room to room or in to out or out to in or sand to water to, stone to grass, whatever, to just think what is propelling me across that threshold. And in that moment, I can wish that anyone who has the wish for that thing in that moment, that they also get, what it is that I'm hoping to get by going across that threshold. So anytime, going across the threshold, you can think about, what is it? There's something that I want that's propelling me across this, And there's probably other people who also want the same thing, and so I can make it bigger and wish that they get whatever it is. And then the other one is just a breath. I mean, so many people don't even have clean air to breathe. So every breath, we could say, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone had a good clean breath to take right now?
One other form of generosity is freedom from fear by not causing harm to others, by being kind to the little insects in your house and to the animals that are around you, and to even, you know, if you choose to eat meat, you know, to at least appreciate that the animals gave their life for you, to, you know, show them, at least in their next life, a little generosity, a freedom from fear, in their next lives. And also, when you encounter people, just giving them a smile, you know, just giving them a little piece of your joy or your peace with a smile. There's in so many different ways.
Yeah, so thank you for reminding us about the types of generosity. Yeah. Gifts of the teaching, gifts of fearless, material gifts. Okay, so are we ready to move on to the next one? Okay. All right, so let's read the Perfection of Morality, LC 102, on page 156 and 157. I seek your blessings to complete the perfection of moral discipline, not transgressing the bounds of the Pratimoksha, Bodhisattva, and Tantric vows, even at the cost of my life, accumulating virtuous dharmas and accomplishing the purpose of sentient beings. Okay, so if I may, I'd like to read some of the things. Okay, so Geshe said there are three types of perfection. Refraining from or abandoning misdeeds of your three doors. These three doors are body, speech, and mind. And then there are three types of vows, as mentioned here, Padimoksha, Bodhisattva, and Tantric vows. So there's the ethics of refraining from or abandoning misdeeds, ethics of gathering virtues through body, speech, and mind, and the ethics of working for the welfare of others, of all sentient beings. So those are the three types of ethics. So Geshe-la said, practicing ethics is taking, practicing, and protecting the Pratimoksha, Bodhisattva, and Tantric vows, even at the cost of your life. And because we live in the time when the teachings are degenerating, it said that if we can practice even one vow purely, we will receive equal benefit as practicing all the vows purely during the time when the teachings were flourishing, like when Shakyamuni Buddha was actually teaching. And by engaging in the three types of vows, the Pratimoksha, Bodhisattva, Tantric vows, this is the practice of the perfections. And now, so, in case people didn't know, I don't think Geshe-la mentioned this, but I'll, you know, the Pratimoksha vows. So they're one-day vows, or eight precepts. Those are just the 24-hour vows that we take, eight of them. And then there's the lay vows, lay man, lay woman vows, and there are five vows. There's the Rabjung vows, there are eight vows. This is before you become a novice monk or a fully ordained monk, it's Rabjung vows. And there's the novice monk or nun vows, and they have 36 vows. Fully ordained nuns have 364 vows, and fully ordained monks have 253 vows. And then the Bodhisattva vows, there are 18 root downfalls and 46 secondary vows. And then I like to read, I don't think Geshe-la read this, but this is very nice. This is from the Victorious Concentration Sutra. Buddha says that if with a calm mind one makes offerings of umbrellas, victory banners, light and jewel ornaments to 100 billion Buddhas for eons equal to the number of sand grains in the Ganges River, a great deal of merit is acquired. However, if during these degenerate times, when the holy Dharma, the teaching of the one gone to bliss, has almost ceased, one keeps just one precept for a day and a night, the merit acquired is far greater than that of giving all those offerings to an uncountable number of Buddhas over such a long period. Okay, so now, any questions or comments about the perfection of ethics or morality?
I just want to say that this, thinking about vows, I think about them very differently now than I did, say, growing up as a Catholic, because the thought of a vow always felt like a rule, a restriction, something that you must not do, whether or not you understand it, just don't do it. And some of the vows that I would hear about seem not to make much sense, but you had to do it anyway because it was the rule. But since going to a lot of Geshe-la's teachings and coming to understand that a vow is something you choose to protect your mind, so it really helps me to think of it in that way. You know, when I say, well, I've chosen to take the vow of do not harm, so it protects me by saying, oh, I promised myself I wasn't going to do that. So it's not that somebody told me not to do it. It's that I'm choosing to do it, and it really does help. So that since I'm telling myself that I promised myself I would not harm, that if I make a mistake, I say, well, I made a mistake. I'm going to go back to my promise. And so it doesn't feel so harsh or dictatorial. It feels like a helpful thing.
Yeah, and just adding to that, it not only protects our minds, but it protects our actions. You know, when we keep our vows, then we're avoiding negative karma, creating positive karma. So it protects our actions as well as our minds.
And I want to add on to that, that I guess with something like a vow, it at least for me personally, I kind of had this tendency to, you know, it's kind of like I was seeing my track record of experience and action through the three doors as how it would be with wishful thinking, whereas, you know, if you, you know, wipe away the wishful thinking and just look at the cold hard facts, like the track record might be a lot crappier than you think it really is. And I think part of that is the level of seriousness we give to something like morality or, you know, and especially with a vow, I think for a lot of people it can potentially give you a lot of empowerment in being able to, stick to your guns, so to speak, in the moment, because moments happen so fast, and the farther you get into how fast they occur, you get super technically aware of just like how fragmented moments are and how easy it is to just, you know, you might have built up progress, you might have been feeling like you're not doing, you know, what you aren't supposed to be doing, or like you might have things that you're not thinking that are as severe as they really are, and it's because you are witnessing these like prolonged moments of good behavior, and then in one of those like one millionth of a moment, like a fragment moment, it like starts to emerge that other bad stuff, and then it's just, you know, it what it takes with a vow can supplement the strength to have the super fast intelligence to see it as that is happening. And, you know, what does the Dalai Lama say? He says counterforce, counterbalance, something like that. So he says the counterforce to he lists the emotion, and he says this is the counterforce to that emotion.
Oh, the antidote.
Yeah, the antidote. So it's like, I think for a lot of people with morality, they tend to have a very they have a bad, or not a bad, it's just a inaccurate view of morality as like a self-reflection, like their own morality, and then like a world reflection. So, you know, I look at the world sometimes and I think it's full of suffering, and then I look at the world other times and I'm thinking there's, you know, I can go to a store and get ice cream, and I can wear like clean clothes and live and that sort of thing, and wash my body with soap. And so that's pretty fortunate. So based on our either experience in the past, present, or future, the amount of energy we put into, acting our views more moral wise, acting out our moral views every day, every moment, is either based on our, I think it's based on how honestly we look at the level of morality we possess in the moment. And then based on each moment, kind of accumulating all the moments, organizing them, making sense of them. And if for the most part, there's like more, you know, morally just moments than morally unjust, we think, oh, you know, I'm good. This is a happy medium. I can just keep it on as this way, and it's not gonna, do anything. But for someone who, I guess, is looking for enlightenment, it would be a complete, I would imagine it would be, I'm not sure what the Buddha says, but a complete, not programming, but it's like programming, but it's like there wouldn't be any moment of unmorality or like dismorality, right? Or like bad morals. There wouldn't be any moment, any fragment of a moment, any one millionth of a moment, even one millionth to the power, no fragmented moments, super fast computer speed, there wouldn't be any frame of bad morals, because immorality, yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah, but along the way, like, I guess the best way to make any progress is to start tracking, you know,
but Tristan,
those moments.
Remember that you're human. And that you're in samsara and you're not perfect. So some of the vows you may think, I think what you were getting at is you can say, I'm a good person, but if you examine it, you may not be. There's the opposite. People who think, I'm a terrible person. But if you examine it, it is not true. But, you know, and you don't have to be perfect. Otherwise, you'd be a Buddha. I mean, I think your intention is good. That's just my thought. I have the best intention, and if I go off track, I get back on track.
Anyone else? No.
Just before we go on to the next one, I had something I wanted to say, which is, at the beginning you talked about the interplay between the perfections, about practicing one with all the other ones. So I'm curious to tease that out a little bit before we go to the third one, because now that we have two to work with, there's a couple different ways to look at it. One is how one leads to the next. Right, so how the perfection of generosity leads to the ability to perfect the morality, so that sort of the reason that they're in the order that they're in. So that's something to talk about. And then the other thing is the part you introduced at the beginning about how we practice one with the other. So I'm just kind of curious about the interplay between them as opposed to the distinctions between them. I don't have anything specific to say, it's just I'd like to hear what other people think about one leading to the next, or practicing one with the other.
I feel like for me, it's kind of like you could look at them in any order and it would work. So, like, one can lead, like, it can happen linearly. Like, if I'm more generous, it'll definitely help me become more moral. But I would say, you could also say, if you know, if you're patient, then it's easier to, you know, feel, you know, relief. And then when you feel the relief, oh, I'm starting to get excited, enthusiasm, and then cross to generosity. I'm feeling excited and I'm patient. I'm going to help my neighbor who's old, and I'm going to mow their lawn or something like that. And then you see, oh, that's what the morals are all about. So it's, I would say, I don't think the order is, it's, you know, perfectly fine to follow it in order or reverse order or crisscross applesauce.
Well, I think that may be true, but I know that generosity is first because it's the easiest to practice. That's why it was first. And of course, wisdom, that's really hard, you know. Of course, then calm abiding and or concentration and wisdom sort of go together. And wisdom certainly is difficult, but.
Wasn't it because I vaguely remember when Tendrin was teaching this and she went through them, and it was so profound and I was so new that you have to have generosity. So that on the baseline that's so simple, it makes sense. But there, it was very rich. It went to great lengths on why it went in order. But you can't actually practice any of the other ones unless you're generous to yourself and to others. Does anybody remember any more about how, you know, what you're asking, literally, why do they go that way? Like, if you didn't practice generosity, you couldn't get to the other ones. I think, was it that clear?
It was that clear, but I don't remember.
Yeah, but then, how could you practice generosity if you don't have morals? You know, you can't steal something and give, you know, and give something that's, you know, something stolen, you know, out of deceit, or, you know, showing, well, I'm going to be generous because, you know, then people will think highly of me, you know, there'd be pride.
They're completely interrelated, but there's still the reason of, and it could just be as simple as, it's the simplest and the easiest, but I remember something really rich about, I don't know if it's in, do you have palm of your hand in there?
Yeah, I do. I didn't see it in the, I was looking in the index. Has anybody found it? I wonder if it's at the beginning.
Because he didn't talk about it in this class, I don't think, right?
The six perfections is near the end.
Yeah, I know. I mean, like, do they have anything about... let's see. I don't think I saw it in here. Yeah, it's very... There's almost nothing before, you know, Rinpoche, Pabongka Rinpoche starts talking about generosity. You know, unless it was, so that's, I think that's a good question for Geshe-la.
Yeah.
I do remember some of Tendrin Law's teaching about it, and I think that one particular link was, I mean, the goal of the profession of generosity is to build the giving mind, right? So once we have a giving mind, then we are less attached to our things and our outcomes, and so it's easier to be moral. So I think that's the link for that one. And then if I spend a minute, I could probably come up with the other ones. But it goes like that, and there is an important order. But then there's also this, you know, you can also look at them linked in those other ways, like you mentioned at the beginning, too. So
yeah, the way Geshe-la said.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, where I am, I'm not going to perfect this one before I start practicing that one. So it's really more of an exercise, but it's just helpful to me to think about the links.
And I don't think that it was meant, you know, well, of course, these are bodhisattva deeds, but isn't this something that we can practice at any level, even on the small scope, right?
Because
this doesn't have to be the perfection. It can just be generosity, right? That's what they... I think that's what Geshe-la said. There's, you know, there's the different levels, like Shravaka and solitary realizer and the one before that. You know, they don't practice the perfections, but they practice, you know, don't practice perfection of generosity, they practice generosity, like that, yeah. Elise, did you want to say something?
I just want to say that when I observe the order, I think much like what Donna and you'd said, roughly a skill level involved, because it is a little easier to start with being generous, at least in little ways, than to, say, do mental stabilization and wisdom, right?
Yeah.
So it does take a little bit more skill to do those. So if you keep them all in mind as you do each one, but personally, I think that there is a little bit of a skill level, a graduation level going on in there, too.
Right. And then, Denise, did you want to add something?
I just remembered one more of the links, which is the perfection of morality has to do with the resolution to do no harm. And so, and then once we have that resolution, we can be patient with, you know, other people as we're trying not to do any harm. So we can take our time to sweep that bug out of the way because we've resolved to do no harm. And then the patience we need to be able to stay on a task with joyful effort. And then we need that enthusiasm or we're not going to sit long enough on our cushion or come back to our cushion to do the concentration. And then without the concentration, with reconcentration, we can get the realization for wisdom. So I think it was something like that. But I was just curious to hear other people's take on that.
I always thought the order was, when I first heard it, I thought the order was odd. And not odd in a bad way, just like, wow, that doesn't make any sense. And then the explanation was so profound because it felt like you should have morality first. You know, I would have picked morality, or I would have, like, if we had to reorganize them, I might have said patience first, or that, I know, you probably need to have enthusiasm. Oh, but you know. And so I think that it was kind of exciting to think, wow, generosity's first. It almost seems like that would be like fifth.
When you think about it, more it makes sense, though.
I know. That's why it's so interesting to talk about it, because you realize, wow, that really does, that is the way it works.
There's a reason.
Great. Okay, ready for patience? Oh, okay. Okay, all right. 157, LC 103. Should even all the beings of the three realms, without exception, become angry at me, humiliate, criticize, threaten, or even kill me, I seek your blessings not to be agitated, but to complete the perfection of patience that works for their benefit in response to their harm. Okay, so Geshe-la said that there are three types of developing patience. Developing the patience of disregarding harm to you. Developing the patience of accepting suffering. Developing the patience of accepting the hardship of putting the teachings into practice. So you talked about, you know, for example, the Tibetan practice of prostrating for months, you know, to get to a holy site. And also he talked about Milarepa's very austere life, you know, where he, all the trials he had to go through, you know, building and taking down stupas and then, you know, living with almost nothing in a cave, eating only nettles and, you know, having just this little white cloth, even in the middle of winter. So those are the some of the practices of patience. And then he said, patience is the antidote to anger. There's no practice like patience. There's no destructive emotion like anger. So he often quotes Shantideva, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Chapter 6, Patience. Stanza 1 is, whatever wholesome deeds, such as venerating the Buddhas and generosity, that have been amassed over 1,000 eons, will all be destroyed in one moment of anger. There is no evil like hatred, and no fortitude like patience. Thus, I should strive in various ways to meditate on patience. And he said, recall the benefit of patience, such as higher rebirth, and recall the drawbacks of anger. So beginners can avoid the object of anger if they are unable to apply patience as the antidote. Anger is a mind in pain. If you harbor that painful mind, you will never experience peace of mind. There is no space for mental or physical happiness, no peace of mind.
Anger is fueled by being thwarted from two types of desire. Desire to want something and desire to not want something. Okay, so any comments or questions about patience?
Amanda says about it, patience makes you pretty.
That's right. I didn't mention that. Yeah, because anger makes you ugly. So the antidote, patience, makes you pretty.
Patience makes you pretty. Yeah,
I think two of the most profound things to me in the teaching on patience, one of them is that, you know, I remember when I first heard that one moment of anger can destroy, you know, eons and eons of merit, you know. And actually, I heard that in the context of make sure you dedicate your merit. But just that thought is kind of terrifying, you know. But when you think about it, you know, how destructive anger can be, that makes sense. But the other thing is, you know, when Geshe-la talked about that, Shantideva says that, you know, he regards anger as like a pain, you know, and that's also seems very, very true from experience. So that's all.
I think with patience, it's so easy to obtain when you feel safe. So in other words, if you're, I know a lot of this stuff is about, you know, being selfless and that sort of thing, and that's ultimately, you know, the truth, but I guess this is a specific, statement in regard to, you can imagine, you know, all the countless people in the world, in different situations, specific situations, where in that moment, they're truly either fearful for their own life, their loved ones, or like many people. And so when you're, if someone's in that place, and they're feeling that way, and it's extended, like I guess you could say when they're deep, when someone's suffering really, really hardcore, a lot of times I think, it's hard for anyone to deal with suffering and deal with it like a bodhisattva would. And so for someone who's not a bodhisattva, being in any kind of like medium to hardcore suffering can really, like, I guess completely transform their whole psychological frame, their identity, their physical body, their opinion, their view, all of the things that we have, it would potentially, you know, twist that. So I guess that's why I have a really personal, I've experienced a lot personally. I don't need to go into very much detail, but, you know, I was really confused about, for a while, I was asking, you know, why did this happen to me? Like, this situation, this crazy situation happened to me, and it all happened, like, all these things, like, one after another. It was, like, so much, so fast, and it was negative, and so I was really, really, you know, transformed by it negatively, truly, like negatively in all extreme ways. And so I had to, I guess, find a way to like keep going through that. And so when I finally found some like, you know, comfortable footing and it wasn't so dire, I started looking at the situation differently and it really started to evolve and I started to really look at everything so differently. And it's so bizarre how just, you know, one hand on the stove and then, you know, it burns and then it heals and then you're sitting in an air conditioned room and you're like, wow, this is so great. And I remember how ungreat it was when my hand was on top of a stove. And so it's not that that person is going to say, oh, this air conditioning makes me hope that everyone in the world never gets AC because they're not going to appreciate the value of it because they've never had their hand on a stove. So I think of patience as something that when you're experiencing, like, life, if you're, I guess, tested in, like, your, in all levels, depending on your support around you, that's really what it boils down to, is the support around you to, I guess, you know, convince you to, you know, either, depending on the situation, you might not have any real control at all. But, like, if you have a situation and you've got the right support, it allows you to have this, like, I guess, like, higher perspective on each, like, each experience in a, in the sense of, like, how it wouldn't, you wouldn't be able to do, you know, the things that you are doing once you've recovered and once you've, you know, seen, I guess, the value in whatever, things that seemed to be, you know, not worth doing. So, like, yeah.
There's a phrase, reframing the situation. So you're seeing it from one side and it's all knotted up. And if you can reframe how you're looking at it, maybe then it flows. Is that kind of what you're saying? Or?
Definitely. But I'm saying, like, with patience, it's something that you as an individual can never develop patience if you expect the journey to be, like, the most smoothest, easygoing, like, no ups and downs. Like, if I could, yeah, exactly.
You mean having expectations?
Yeah,
okay. Oh, Elise wants to talk.
Our teachers always say that we should be grateful for our enemies and for difficult situations because that's how we learn patience. Mm-hmm. If everything goes smoothly, you might think, oh, I'm the most patient person in the world until something happens and you realize that you're really not. So it helps you recognize those qualities in yourself that you need to develop and be grateful for them.
Yeah, that's why I wonder, you know, about the yogis who live in the mountains, you know, and of course they have very few, you know, needs, you know, they have, you know, very few supplies and so forth. It's very little food, very little comfort. But then they don't have anyone to, you know, to really, yeah, to bug you or anything, you know. So I would think that if I were doing that up in the mountain, I set, you know, 6 years up there, 16 years up there, and I came down out of there, you know, all thinking that I'm all fine, like Dory, that I go down and if something happens, I think in a snap, I would probably have amassed 1,000 eons right away, you know, and then that would be the end. It's just like, I think there's a page here in a picture of, in Liberation of this yogi with long hair, yeah, and the rats are eating his hair, and he turned around and he snapped to them, and then he, in his next lifetime, he went, you know, he in the hell realms, and that's just, you know, it's so true. You really need those, you know, you need practice. You need those, incidents of, you know, that are difficult.
Yeah.
You know, maybe something you can handle, but
yeah.
That really helps.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Don.
No, cool.
I know Robina told a student here, and it was interesting, not in a public setting, so I just happened to know, so this is removed once, but he loved to travel and go hiking and everything, and she's like, she said something that I won't repeat, because she's like, you need to be in the city where there are people. Because, you know, you can be so patient when you're hiking and it's beautiful and everything's great, but get here where the crap meets the road, and that's when you really have to practice. And then you, exponentially work really hard because it's in your face. And it's, you know, you're on vacation and it's easier. And so I think we do, we come out of that and we go, oh, we're great. And one little thing happens and we're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, and all of that is like the more profound meaning of you know, why we should be grateful to sentient beings and why they're so essential to us. Because, you know, their kindnesses are nice, but their unkindnesses are great kindnesses because they're great opportunities. If only I would just take those.
Yeah, but it's fine, though, you know, to go and... Oh, I'm sorry, somebody. Oh, just hold on. We'll just get the mic there. You have to turn it on.
And hold it up as if it's an ice cream cone you're about to lick. Otherwise, we don't hear it. Do you have a green light?
Yeah, I think I'm going to. Just the word sentient being. What exactly is that? All everybody? Is that pretty much what that means?
Yeah, and anyone.
Okay.
Yeah, anyone with a mind.
A mind.
Okay. Mind possessor.
A mind possessor.
Yeah.
And would a Buddha be a sentient being, or?
No, a Buddha is an enlightened being.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of the distinction. But the Tibetan term for sentient being is semchen, which literally means mind possessor. So it's anyone that has a mind and awareness, including bugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Okay, any other comments, questions about patience, just patience? Okay, so I guess we better move on because we have, it's getting close. So perfection of enthusiasm 104. Even if I must remain for an ocean of eons in the fiery house of Avicii, for the sake of even just one sentient being, I seek your blessing to complete the perfection of enthusiasm that out of compassion untiringly strives for supreme enlightenment. Okay, so he said, according to Abhidhamma Kosha written by Vasubandhu, joyful effort is defined as a mind that is pleased by positive activities. The perfection of enthusiasm is like a cloak. If you wear that cloak, your knowledge and experience will increase like a waxing moon. Your behavior will be beneficial. Whatever project you take on, the more likely it will be completed and not be postponed. He said, why do we need to, you know, work on our projects? Because tomorrow may never come. So if you want to do something good, we need to do it now. And he likes to mention Heart Spoon. So I'd like to read just a couple of stanzas from that. It's by Pabongka Rinpoche. You appear so capable, smart, and clever, but you're a fool as long as you cling to the child's play of the appearances of this life. Suddenly, you're overwhelmed by the fearful lord of death. And without hope or means to endure, there's nothing you can do. This is going to happen to you. Because you think, I'm not going to die for some time, I'm not going to die for some time, while you're distracted by the never-ending activities of this life, suddenly the fearful lord of death arrives, announcing, now it's time to die. This is going to happen to you. Then he mentioned three factors incompatible with joyful effort. Stopping the laziness of procrastination, stopping attachment to ignoble activities, like doing all kinds of other things besides spiritual practice, the distraction. He calls these distractions. Because, why are they distractions? Because when we die, all those activities will become nothing. You know, it won't, it'll just go away. Yeah, that's what he's saying. And the thing, the positive activities that we do, the spiritual practice will, you know, continue. You know, there'll be the merit will continue. And then the third is stopping discouragement or self-contempt. All spiritual knowledge is the product of effort. No effort, no result. Happy to meditate, happy to read, happy to say mantras, happy to see people because we see the benefits. To practice joyful effort, we need to develop the willpower or mind power
to live in the worst of the worst conditions, eons and eons, just to save one sentient being, even an ant or a roach. So this is a bodhicitta. So when you get cold, you think, may I experience this cold so that no sentient being has to experience this cold. When you are enjoying life, imagine everyone is having a wonderful time. Once you have bodhicitta, every movement, every action becomes Dharma practice and the cause for enlightenment. Our focus should be on our ultimate goal, enlightenment, and not be discouraged that it may take many years or eons to complete. When bodhisattvas practice the perfection of joyful effort or enthusiasm, they rely on four powers: aspiration, steadfastness, joy, and relinquishment. And what they're relinquishing is the self-centered mind. In short, no matter, so, you know, in short, is that part of the thing? In short, no matter what our practice we are going to undertake, the success of that practice comes about on the basis of having the strong aspiration of yearning for the outcome or goal of that practice. Okay, so, perfection of enthusiasm.
I think this ties in a little bit with what we're talking about with vows. If you're going to do something, do it because you want to do it and you know that it's beneficial to yourself and others. Without enthusiasm, you're just doing something rotely or because somebody told you to or you think you have to do it. So that's my interpretation of what the enthusiasm is all about. Doing it because you know that it's the right thing and a benefit to yourself and others.
So this is kind of there's two thoughts that come to mind. So I guess I'll start with the thoughts I have on the, what is it? Enthusiasm. On the power and the positivity, or not the power, but just like the transformative qualities that enthusiasm gives you. And that is how, I guess, you, as in anyone, being enthusiastic is like, how do they describe it? It's like, it is contagious. So in other words, if you even, I used to try to do this on some days at work, wherever I was, and that was just, I would come into work and I would see, you know, I would see my coworkers and they all look tired and dreary and, you know, not that they were sad or anything, but they were just obviously still tired because it's early in the morning. And so I would just like try to, you know, be as like enthusiastic and positive and like with each thing, like really. And I think enthusiasm is a word that people interpret as they interpret it based on their understanding of the word. So enthusiasm for one person might mean a specific body language or tone or like the level of volume or like that sort of thing in their voice. And then for others, it can be interpreted as like the, like I guess more the same things that you're looking at, but it's less about, it's like with each person, they might say, oh, they seemed pretty enthusiastic about this. And then someone else might say, oh, well, they didn't seem very enthusiastic. Why do you think they're so enthusiastic? And then they'd say, oh, I've known this person for 20 years and this is, you know, they're usually so reserved and withdrawn and blah, 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 blah. But with enthusiasm, it's like contagious. So you can affect others with your enthusiasm. So if you are in a place like, you know, a workplace or a social group or a school group or a political group or a political party, and you're interactive with that community and you have this enthusiasm and you bring this, you know, I guess, liveliness to whatever it is, it's gonna, you know, spark it up in everyone else. And then when other people likewise do that, it just really magnifies the potential, whatever the goals are of that group or purpose. It's like if you are in a, you know, basketball team and you've got a basketball coach that's like, you know, super enthusiastic, and you've got one guy on the team who's super enthusiastic, before you know it, you got a couple, and then the whole team's enthusiastic and you're the best team in the league.
Yeah, we're running out of time, so maybe we can move on to concentration.
Okay, all right. Our mental stabilization, 105. Mm-hmm. Having abandoned the faults of thinking, agitation, and mental wandering, I seek your blessing to complete the perfection of mental stabilization to the samadhi of single-pointed placement upon the nature of reality of all phenomena, their lack of true existence. Okay, so Gessler said the purpose of this practice is to eradicate all the defilements or afflictions from my mind stream. Simple concentration will not cut the root of samsara. So this is from Songs of Spiritual Experience. Concentration is the king that reigns over the mind. When left, it is as unwavering as the king of mountains. When set forth, it engages with all objects of virtue. It induces the great bliss of a serviceable body and mind. Single-pointed meditation is like the king of the mind that rules all the thoughts. To be present, make our mind calm and peaceful, people need to practice single-pointed meditation. The benefit of this is a well-balanced mind and body. The mind is flexible, not uptight. Not my way or the highway, right? The ultimate result is physical pliancy and mental pliancies. So there are five prerequisites. Dwelling in an appropriate environment, having few wants, being content, having pure ethics, and abandoning the demands of society. And then there are two obstacles. There are many, many different objects that you can use in your meditation practice. There's no one definite object. And what you use is an internal object, a mental image. So even like if you use a statue of Shakyamuni Buddha, for example, you know, you're not trying to visualize this physical statue. You know, it's actually a mental image. So there's two obstacles, thinking mind and excited mind. Thinking mind, when the mind is thinking, what you do is you visualize a bright light, like sunlight or moonlight. And if that doesn't help, splash some water on your face. And if it's with thinking mind, you don't lose the object. It's just not clear and there's no energy. And for excited mind, you actually lose the object. And you think of something that you don't know, or meditate on the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, to lower the energy of the mind. And the rabbit in the tanka symbolizes thinking mind, and the monkey symbolizes excited mind. And so there's subtle thinking mind, and that's when there is slight decrease in the sharpness of the object. So you still hold the object, but it's not as sharp. And the mind, yeah. And gross thinking mind is when the mind is still on the object with some clarity, but the sharpness is gone. So excited mind is the mind that's carried away by some form of attachment. So your mind starts to create stories based on something desirable. And then the five objects of desire are, you know, form, sound, smell, taste, tactile. And the wandering mind is a larger category, and it can be caused by desirable or undesirable objects. So the object could be anger or pride, or it could be something positive. Like, for example, if you were meditating on your breath, and then you your mind scattered to like a tanka, and you said, oh, how a beautiful, you know, tanka of Medicine Buddha, and that's a distraction. That's wandering mind, even though it's, you know, a positive thing. Okay, and so wandering mind, so excited mind is within the category of wandering mind. And he said you can practice your breathing in and out and counting breaths, like breathing out and breathing in, count one, and so forth. And I'm trying to go a little faster. And then you can combine breathing meditation with some other form of practice, such as Tonglen, taking and giving. So you, he just mentioned exhaling. He didn't mention inhaling. He said you can exhale goodness, loving kindness, compassion, all your goodness that you possess in the form of light, and that reaches all living beings. That's it.
I think for the sake of time, we can just move on now to wisdom.
Wisdom, okay. Okay, wisdom. The perfection of wisdom, the space-like practice of voidness during the meditation session. I seek your blessing to complete the perfection of wisdom, the space-like yoga of single-minded placement upon ultimate truth, conjoined with the pliancy and great bliss induced by the discriminating wisdom analyzing suchness.
All three of them,
I seek your blessings to perfect the samadhi and illusion by realizing how outer and inner phenomena lack true existence but still appear like a mirage, a dream, or the moon's image on a still lake. Samsara and nirvana lack even an atom of true existence, and cause and effect and dependent arising are infallible. I seek your blessing to discern the meaning of Dharmarajuna's thought that these two are mutually complementary and not contradictory. Okay, so should we just dedicate now?
Yeah, let's just go ahead and dedicate.
Okay, so let's see. Going back to the gold prayer book. let's see, what should we do? Should we do Gewadir 235? Yeah. Let's do the dedication prayers on page 235. You can do it in English. That's in the gold prayer book.
It should be in the back of the chair. Just in the back of your chair?
Any chair, back of any chair. Page 235, General Dedication Prayers, 235. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Okay, and then go to 244 and 245. So start with 244. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good, all-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. And then the other side at the bottom, the one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. And then for Lama Zofa Rinpoche, you uphold the subduer's moral way, who serves as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And then Green Tara's mantras for Geshe-la and Geshe Sampo's long, healthy, happy lives. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.